The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the pod, the latest in our series looking at the life and times of our panellists. Today's subject, or victim, depending on how he feels about it, is Jonathan Loo, a huge signing by The Guardian from The Independent a year or so ago. But who is he and how does he work? We'll talk about his path into journalism, being one of the few non-white faces in the press box, being a Countdown champion 8 times, and his willingness to call people out in print. And there's sometimes interesting reactions. Jonathan Agnew is mentioned. We'll also look ahead to some Premier League football, and Sid Lowe joins us from Spain following the return of La Liga. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. So the panel today is Barry Glendenning. Hey, Baz.
Hey, Max. How are you?
Nice to have you back. Did you miss doing the pod? Were you worried the pod was too good while you were away?
No, I did listen to yesterday's pod where it was asked of the panelists how long they would let me stay in their houses if for some reason I had nowhere to stay. And I was absolutely appalled to learn that Flo Lloyd Hughes and Faye Carruthers Flo would let me in to use the loo and give me a glass of water, and Faye Carruthers would not let me in the door at all, which was heartwarming. I, as someone, a single man who my flat tends to be a refuge for friends and acquaintances who find themselves in domestic, in the doghouse, say, and they might turn up with a suitcase. The correct answer to the question is of how long you will let anyone stay is exactly 2 weeks.
Jonathan Loo, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How long would you let Barry stay with you if he turned up with a small suitcase, with a stick and a hanky on the back of it, with his belongings rolled into it?
He could stay in our cupboard indefinitely.
Would you let him out of the cupboard?
No. No. He could pass messages through the cupboard. We'd turn the lights on for maybe like an hour a day.
It is easier for me to let people stay, as I don't have anyone who wouldn't want them there, you know.
Yeah, or we'd need to get into the cupboards a couple of times a day to get the pram, and he'd need to be okay with that.
Fine. Anyway, this pod mainly will be about the life and times of you, Johnny. Do you like talking about yourself?
Well, I should probably say something like, oh, it's very embarrassing, it's always excruciating. I actually quite like talking about myself. It's one of the very few subjects that I don't have to research thoroughly before talking about. Fire away.
Here's a question from Dale, which I think is particularly apt for the two people you're talking to at the moment. Jonathan is so eloquent. How much does he have to dumb down what he's saying to connect with his colleagues?
This is a myth. It's a myth that I'm eloquent. I mean, if you see me at a game, I will literally have Microsoft Word on one half of the screen and a thesaurus on the other. I actually bought a thesaurus when I was about 16 and read it, just read it like a book,
like cover to cover.
Yeah, I mean, I thumbed it, and not cover to cover, but not front leaf to back leaf, but it was it was a good friend of mine when I started out. So it's just a way of making myself look a little bit cleverer than I actually am, isn't it?
So, can I just state for the record, Jonathan, that I got your front leaf to back leaf thesaurus joke, even if Max didn't.
Ironically, I couldn't actually think of a synonym for cover.
Well, I was frantically trying to think of one as well, and I couldn't either.
But at least you've worked out you have to dumb it down for me and not for Barry, and that makes me feel terrible. Okay, then let's start at the beginning of Junior Loo. Your first sporting memory, please.
Probably Lineker getting substituted at Euro 92. It was either that or the missed penalty against Brazil. And the first season I properly remember is 92-3. So yeah, it would be Lineker coming off for Alan Smith at the Euros. My football consciousness starts in 1992, which I think is quite a neat way to start your football watching life, because people say like, well, football existed before 1992, you know, and I went, well, not for me really.
But also quite nice that your England supporting trend began in such a devastating, you know, sort of an ultimate terrible way, that perhaps you don't have expectations that others have.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that 94 qualifying campaign, the Graham Taylor end days was pretty much my introduction to English football, to being an England football fan. And I remember watching that game in Holland and for the first time crying after a game of football, after they lost 2-0 and Ronald Koeman should have been sent off. And my mum saying it was only football. I think everybody goes through this process at some point where somebody who doesn't understand tries to tell you that football doesn't matter. And you go, but it does matter. It does matter. And that's kind of a conversation that I've been having with loved ones ever since.
Who did you grow up supporting?
Spurs, which is something that maybe not a lot of people know. But yeah, I went to school in North London. So Spurs was my team.
I'm trying to think, 92, who was your sporting hero? Is that too early for Stuart Nethercott?
Well, the 92-3 Spurs team was kind of a little bit of a Bermuda Triangle of football, really. So, I mean, it was, I think, Torsvet, Austin, Edinburgh. So, yeah, I mean, it was a really tough time because you heard about all the great memories and you know the great tradition that Spurs had. And it was the same with Middlesex, actually, in the cricket. I started supporting them in 1994, which was the year when they basically stopped winning stuff. And so it's an incredible character building tutelage in sporting failure.
Did you go to watch Middlesex? I don't know if I've ever met anyone who's gone to county cricket.
I went a lot as a teenager. They did this incredible student membership, which for like, I don't know, something ridiculous, like £25 a year or something, you could go and watch all the cricket. So when I was old enough to get the three buses to Lords, I grew up in West London. I'd go down quite often and would, you know, would watch some truly, truly terrible cricket. That was my upbringing.
What's the Lords crowd like on a midweek in a county game?
It's pretty dead. It's basically like, I mean, on a sunny Saturday afternoon, it's very different from a drab Wednesday or Thursday morning. But essentially, you've got about 50 guys, most of whom will be over 50, over 60, slowly getting, you know, drunker over the course of the day. And as it gets to sort of mid-afternoon and the booze starts flowing a bit more, somebody will start a chant of middle, 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 and somebody on the other end of the stand will shout sex, 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 which is, as a 15-year-old, you find that hilarious, and you go home and you tell all your friends about it, you tell your family about it. I heard this brilliant chant, and they give you a look.
I'm 47 and I find it hilarious.
It's quite good, isn't it? Whoever came up with that?
Johnny, were you a child genius?
I was an only child, and I think that, you know, very much like Wilson, actually, who I've often described as the onlyest of only children. I think you end up ploughing yourself into things that you maybe wouldn't have done if you'd had other people your own age around. So I read and read and read and would write out, you know, football scores and cricket results and therefore have this incredible recall for things that I've read when I was, you know, 7 years old, that occasionally several decades on manifests itself, or, you know, with the veneer of actual, you know, smartness or insight, when it's just I've got this kind of savant like recall of stuff that I was reading when I was seven because I had nothing else to do. I was good at maths. I mean, I don't know if a lot of people will notice, but I was on Countdown.
Oh yeah.
About 6 or 7 years ago. I was quite good at numbers. But in terms of being like a child genius, I don't think I was sort of on that sort of level.
Because I often called Wilson Johnny Five, but should I transfer that from him to you? It's this sort of this desire for it, more input and more input, and you know, Wilson has so much ludicrous knowledge, and I suspect you do too, that I just don't have, or I don't have the capacity for.
Yeah, but I think Wilson has the he's still got capacity to keep adding to it. Whereas I think I hit my limit. About 50, 60, around the age I started drinking, I think, and it's never really, and basically everything else has been, has just been sort of like pouring water into it, into a full pot. So, I mean, just over these last 2 or 3 months, it's incredible, like the amount of football I've forgotten. So I think that's the difference between me and him. But I had quite a lot of capacity when I was younger, and I literally filled it all up with county cricket rosters from the 1990s.
But you mentioned there, Jonathan, you were on Countdown. You weren't just on Countdown. You became an Octo Champ. Yeah, basically, you won 8 episodes in a row, which is the maximum you're allowed, I think.
Yeah. Once you win 8 in a row, they basically say, that's enough now. Please go away. But I mean, once you've won your first one, the first one is the hardest, because everything's so new and you're so kind of overwhelmed by the whole strangeness of the experience that you kind of actually, forget that you have like words and numbers to grapple with. So once you win one, you feel so much more relaxed and confident. And that's why I think you get so many people going on a run, because they're all coming up against people who are doing it for the first time. And by sort of episode 7 or 8, you're almost sort of breezing onto set, like giving everyone a cheery wave. Oh, hey, Rachel. Hey, Susie. And like the other person sitting there, like absolutely petrified. It's worth 10, 15 points on its own.
At what point did you think you wanted to make a career out of writing?
My dad used to come home with the newspapers. He used to get the Times and the Independent, and I would lay them out on the carpet and sit and read the football reports. And I remember saying to him one time, like, these guys, I think it was Rob Hughes or something who would write for the Times. Does this guy Rob Hughes get to go to football for free? And he was like, yeah, he goes, well, that's what I want to do then. Because it was very clear from an early age that I wasn't going to make it as an actual footballer. That was always a very distant ambition, but in the same way that like being an astronaut was an ambition, or being some sort of, being a superhero, it didn't seem like something that was in any way tangible. Even well into my teens and after going to uni, the idea that you could make a career out of, just talking and writing nonsense about sport just seems very distant.
So what was your pathway and how easy did you find it?
I went to uni and did the student paper there. And that really got my, that's where I got the bug for writing really, really stupid stuff. And then I went on I applied for the Telegraph's graduate scheme. I did some work experience at Observer Sport Monthly, the much missed Observer Sport Monthly, and the Wisden Cricketer magazine. And then, I applied for the Telegraph graduate scheme and got on. And the pathway, I think, was I basically assumed I was going to be sort of uploading content onto the web or something for the next 20 years. But then at the end of that, a vacancy popped up on Sport, and I met sort of the sports editor David Bond in the Gents, and we had this really surreal conversation in at the urinals, where he goes like, "Oh, we might have a vacancy on Sport going." All right, oh, well, that would be great. Oh yeah, we'll see what we can do. And then sort of shake, and off we went, and that was basically the start of it.
Do you remember the first sports event or sports thing you wrote about?
The first game I covered for the Telegraph, this is when I was still on the grad scheme, was I think Southampton against Northampton in the League Cup. This would have been August 2009. I think that was it. And Southampton was still in League One at the time. And so that whole first season, I covered mainly sort of Championship, League One games. The first like really terrible intro I remember writing was from Norwich 5, Wickham 2. Like Paul Lambert has put the song back into the Canaries, and I still think about that most days. When I'm sitting with a blank Microsoft Word document at a game, or I have to write a column, I think, come on, it can't possibly be as bad as that.
We asked Barney about the process of writing. Like, do you have one? Do you have a sort of template that you always go to, a method that you always have?
No, I mean, I listened to that too, and I was kind of taking notes, trying to listen for tips, to be honest. If there is a method to writing, I haven't really discovered it yet. What basically happens is I will do a lot of research, do probably too much research, read a lot, get extremely intimidated by the complexity and the breadth of the topic, and then I'll get a call from John Brodkin or Marcus saying, like, it's 3 p.m. Jonathan, we really need your copy. And I'm like, oh, Christ. And then I'll essentially just bash something out. And often the stuff that you just bash out off the top of your head is turns out a lot better than the stuff you were sort of meticulously planning for the 3 days previous to that. It's a funny thing. It's so much of writing is about momentum, and that's why I think it's so defies this idea of method and structure. And I have so much admiration for people who can write in blocks of time or to a schedule, because I've never really been able to do that.
But you say you just bash the stuff out, Jonathan, but I think, and I could be wrong here, but you seem to really find your voice during the last World Cup, and the colour pieces and match reports you were bashing out were remarkable, like in how good they were. And people over here, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but people were really sitting up and taking notice of you and how good your work was. Were you aware of that? And is it fair to say that that's kind of when you found your voice, or is it just when I became aware of how good you were?
I think that's certainly the most fun I've had in terms of writing. And I don't know, it's not really for me to say, like, whether, you know, how good it was or anything like that, but it certainly got a lot of traction because it was the World Cup, because people were watching. And it's certainly, I think, easier to get people's attention and to touch people's emotions when you've got this incredibly big spotlit event like that. I mean, the really hard thing is getting people interested in, I don't know, Preston against Leicester in the Championship, like I was doing sort of 10 years ago. So I think a lot of that is people feeling lots of things about the World Cup, whether it's Messi, you know, against Nigeria, or whether it's England in the penalty shootout. And then something, a piece comes along, which, I don't know, some captures or chimes with what they were already feeling. And I think that's why it generated so much of a kind of an emotional reaction, because the emotional reaction was kind of there already, but it just sort of, I harnessed people's emotions basically and cynically, you know, harvested them for my own career advancement.
I don't know how, I don't know if it is cringeworthy to read out your own stuff to you, but like, we had a question from SHL saying, look, Johnny's report at Anfield after the Barcelona game was extraordinary. Can he share how he was able to sum up the game so soon after the final whistle? And I've got a paragraph that I'll read, because I guess some people listening may not be able to just bring it into their mind immediately. This is Liverpool's gift, to rip up what you thought you knew about football and footballers, to take you mentally and physically to a place you don't know and never wanted to go, to make your eardrums ring and your sinuses twang and your heart thump to the point where it's all you can think about, to the point where you start to question yourself, to the point where you don't realise you've left a massive gap in your left channel until it's just a fraction of a second too late. How were you able to do that report on the final whistle? A lot of journos noticed that.
I got extremely lucky with the way the game unfolded. I mean, as anyone who's kind of written a live match report will know, you're totally at the mercy of events. And so right at the start, I decided this was going to be about Liverpool fighting back. And they were, you know, whether they succeeded or whether they didn't, it was going to be like a hell of a tale. And it might not have been. Like, Barcelona could have scored after 10 minutes or they could have scored a couple of goals early in the second half and it would have ruined the whole thing. But what happened was because it seemed like when people read the report that it had been done, you know, almost, you know, it had flowed almost instantaneously. But that was really just an accident of how the game turned out because Liverpool scored early and it just kept building and building and building. And there was something about the atmosphere there, about even the journalists in the press box, like sitting there open mouthed and with, you know, wide eyed, and that, I don't know, you just kind of cotton onto that a little bit, and you just, the words just come out because your blood's pumping a little bit and you're not really thinking about it too much. And I think I got lucky that the narrative of the game really just only ever unfolded in that one direction. And again, that was one of those pieces that was able to harness an emotional tide that people were already on. And I think that's why it chimed with a lot of people.
All right, we'll carry on with the life and times of Johnny Lou in just a second. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. Johnny, we've talked about racism in sport a lot recently. We've talked about it in the media. We've talked about it on the pod and representation on the pod as well. Have you ever experienced it in your professional life?
Not. I don't feel like I've ever really experienced it from colleagues or in the workplace. In terms of, you know, feedback online, you know, comments from readers, comments on social media, there has been some of that, although I think a lot less now. Structurally, I don't feel like it's held me back. Occasionally, you know, you'll be in a press conference or something, and somebody will come along and say, like, "Oh, this actually happened. Actually, I was at Carrington, and somebody from BBC Radio Manchester goes like, we're talking to foreign journalists about the derby coming up. Can we get your viewpoint?" And, you know, it's harmless, but obviously you realise that you've been profiled because of the way you look in a way that nobody else in the room has. But I definitely wouldn't stack up my experience in the industry alongside, you know, the very kind of very real and tangible discrimination that a lot of people from other ethnicities face.
And you haven't, I don't know if you, it seems, you know, it's such a white male industry, it's such a white industry, that you don't, I mean, I don't know if you, do you look there and notice how white it is? We're having these conversations a lot at the moment, or well, not really?
I think I probably do more now than I did at the start. I've always noticed how white male cricket crowds are, for example, and that it seemed to me that the press box was really no different. And I think it's very much the same with football. Even when I started out in 2009, 2010, I don't think it would have occurred to me to demographically audit the press room or the press box. But now I think people are more aware of issues like representation and diversity, even the diversity of your own social groups. And so I think it makes more sense to do that now than it would have done when I started out, even though that sounds a little bit like a cop out. But I think that you can still walk into a press room, and maybe this is less common in London than it is elsewhere in the country, but you can walk into a press room and there'll be 40 people in it and all of them will be white. Oh, you know, very often all of them will be male, or the only females will be, you know, the ones with working for the telly, or occasionally the only BAME people apart from me would be serving the teas. And that would, that often that optic is extremely uncomfortable. And that's something that I think is becoming more and more noticeable. The more that this issue gets put on the table.
You're not afraid of controversy or calling people out. Most people
That makes me sound like a real dickhead.
No.
It's like something you said to Jordan Peterson. You're certainly very controversial.
No, but I mean, it's interesting because I mean, most people avoid confrontation and probably not always for the right reasons. I'm trying to work out if it's, you know, there's a scale of bravery to shit stirring, and I wonder where it falls for you.
Yeah, I think I don't know, maybe this is like a really sort of pig-headed male thing to say, but I've always just tried to just write what I think and kind of screw the consequences. There's definitely a spectrum of journalists, and yeah, I want to sort of choose my words carefully here, but there are certain journalists, I think, who are much more reliant than I am on maintaining lines of access, maintaining relationships with, I guess, agents or organizations, because a larger part of their work is finding news stories, for example, which is something I do less of. And I guess the other side of that is that if you're not necessarily, if maintaining those relationships or maintaining those lines of communication isn't as integral to the doing of your job, like it is in my case, then maybe you have a little bit more latitude to, I don't know, shit on people. Mm.
Well, Rich says, have you made friends with Aggers? King of Shebang says, snog, marry, avoid. Jonathan Agnew, Matthew Syed, Robbie Savage. Peter says, and you'll have to bleep out one of these words, Sammy, hashtag gate autopsy, please. Can we talk about Jonathan Agnew?
If you want, yeah.
There'll be some people who don't know who he is.
Jonathan Agnew is the cricket correspondent for the BBC. I don't think it's unfair to say there's a touch of the Victorian lady about him.
the converse argument is he's a national treasure, right? He's been doing Test Match Special, which is the BBC's cricket commentary, for years and years and years.
Yeah. But he can get quite upset very easily, and Jonathan Agnew and Jonathan Liu had quite a famous, is it a feud? But it certainly started as a frank exchange of views on Twitter.
A frank exchange of profane views, I think, is the technical term. I suppose this all blew up about a year ago when I wrote a column for The Independent, which I was working for at the time, about Jofra Archer, and the England cricketer who was born in Barbados, had qualified to play for England, and just the language that people were using to describe his entrance to the team in comparison to other white players who had qualified for England having been born elsewhere. And I felt there was a slight disconnect there. And the column was not about Agnew at all. I mentioned probably a dozen people, a lot of England players who had spoken about Archer in the same way. But, you know, he took specific exception to, and then, you know, I can kind of understand why, that if you see something like that written about you, you've got to think, well, this guy's calling me a racist, which I very, very, you know, specifically went out of my way not to do, because I thought these issues are far too complex to be dealt with in like this very simplistic, you know, he's a racist, this is racist, this is not racist. And I think part of the reason we were at slight cross purposes is because he seemed to be operating on this binary of, well, I'm not racist, this is racism and it's something I'm not. And my column, which was, I think, a little bit more taking the view that it's something that we can all subconsciously slip into at times, quite unwittingly. And I think that's where the slight difference of opinion occurs. And then I think I was on the train back from Manchester, from Old Trafford, from a United Chelsea game. It was a Sunday evening, and I started getting all these direct messages on Twitter. And I apologize again now to the passengers on the 2012 from Manchester Piccadilly to London Euston, for the guy in seat D12 or wherever it was, just like spending 2 hours just chuckling away at his phone and staring at his phone and taking like endless screenshots because Agus had gone on a little bit of a DM rant at me, which he used the C word a few times, and I thought that that was as telling as in a way as what he'd said about Joffa Archer, in that his instinct was, I guess, to try and other me, to try and cast me and by extension what I've been writing as, I guess, a sort of a fringe view from a fringe member of the press box. I thought that was quite telling. It spoke of a certain clubbiness, like this is the club and you are outside of it. So that's what I found quite interesting as well.
You went on, Jonathan, to publish the DMs he'd sent you, make them public. At the time, I'd be honest, I think you're a top bloke. I thought that was out of order. Do you have any regrets about doing that?
I didn't, just because they were private correspondence. I didn't initially mean to, but. And certainly, if that had been the end of it, I certainly wouldn't have gone any further. I might have made some sort of private complaint, but he carried on very publicly on social media, describing me as a racist for what I'd written, which I thought was pretty out of order. And I think it wasn't like for another 2 or 3 weeks. That he was sort of trying to portray himself as, you know, this wronged party who had simply proffered a very reasonable view and had been assailed by this racist columnist, and I thought that was a view that needed challenging with evidence.
So do you think I'm out of order for thinking you were out of order?
No, that's definitely a valid opinion. That, you know what. You know, it's a private conversation, and that should remain private. I can definitely see that point of view. You know, equally, you could say he's the BBC cricket correspondent, and he's a public figure, and he's acting very differently in private to the way he acts in public. And he's, I guess. I think the word that was used by somebody else was he was certainly trying to bully a younger journalist, and you can take a view on whether that's an appropriate way of dealing with that. But I guess as we've established, I'm not afraid of being Jordan Peterson at times.
What happened with Robbie Savage?
Oh my gosh, this is turning to ambush. This is something I wrote for the Telegraph about. This would have been about 5 or 6 years ago now. The headline was something like "Bobby Savage represents the triumph of personality over character," something like that. It was about the way that his punditry, and it wasn't just about him. Although I gather, you know, it was mostly about him. But it was about this phenomenon where people on who are supposedly in positions of impartial, kind of dispassionate, roles in the media, whether it's to give analysis or to pass judgment on events, essentially make that job about their own personality and their own foibles, and essentially, you know, create a character out of doing that job. It was quite nuanced, I thought, but Robbie, you know, didn't agree. He didn't take the same view as me, and having obtained my phone number from a colleague in the press box who shall remain Henry Winter, he called me up. He phoned me up to take issue with a piece, and. And did so in the strongest possible terms, I think it's fair to say.
But the one thing I would say about Robbie is, I mean, I know for a fact all three of us have had individual spats with him for one reason or another. He he's not, well, in my experience, he's not one to hold a grudge, you know, so I will give him that.
No, and you know, like, since then, he's been, you know, we've had chats on the phone, and we've had, you know, we've seen each other in the press box, and he's, you know, he's been very complimentary about stuff that I've written about him specifically. So, and the same with Agnew, really. It's nothing personal. It's just, I have a job where this makes sound like a dick, but, you know, I'm in a job where I've got to call it like I see it. And it's never really anything personal. I mean, it did take that, the conversation with Robbie Savage did sort of then veer into that area where he said, like, so, like, why, like, what do I need to do to get better as a pundit? Because I'm trying to get better. And I was sort of explaining to him the gist of the piece, was that it's not anything specific that you said. It's not points that you're making. It's you. It's literally you. So you would essentially need like a whole personality lobotomy. And I think that's the point at which that's the point at which I lost him, I think.
Finally, who is Johnny Lou's favourite Irish football journalist? Asked Mark. Is it Barry, Miggsy, or Ken Early?
Gosh, that's tough. I think, you know what, for the first time, I'm actually going to plead the fifth on that.
Really? Who do you respect most as a journalist?
Ken is great. Ken is really good. Mm. But Barry's very underrated as a journalist,
actually. Is he?
Barry's a really underrated writer.
Is he really?
He is, because people think of Barry as like this kind of, this sort of podcast radio personality now. But actually his writing, like his reporting from the Tour de France, for example, is always really good. Sorry, Barry. This is very embarrassing.
I don't know how you're going to
process this, but yeah, I've always found Barry underrated as a writer.
Oh, I never read any of his stuff. all right, that'll do for part two. That was your Life and Times, Johnny. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll do a bit of Project Restart. Premier League is back, and we'll talk to Sid in Spain as well. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, the Premier League is back Wednesday night. Lots of new COVID regulations have come in. Johnny, you were quite vocal in saying it shouldn't be coming back a few weeks ago. Have you changed your mind at all?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I think I've just got really bored of lockdown. And I know in print I've been extremely vocal about... I remember coming on the pod at the start of lockdown and just sort of wistfully staring into space like some dead donkey. And going like,
that was on day one.
I was like, yes. It's all pointless. But I think that's what, you know, 3 months of lockdown does to you. I literally can't wait for this, you know, sordid narrative fest to get going and to actually get out of the house and get to a ground at 2:55, walk straight to my seat without any contact with anybody else, which is kind of how I ideally like to consume my football anyway.
Aston Villa, Sheffield United, Wednesday, 6 o'clock. Huge game for both. Seems strange to say sentences like that. I was listening to Ian Wright, who said he thought form was still a thing and that Sheffield United will still be confident and Villa won't be confident, even though this break has been longer than a normal close season. Do you agree with him or not, Baz?
I don't know, to be honest. Has form gone out the window? We shall see. I suspect it might have. I mean, previewing these games is just weird because it's almost like it's an entirely new season. I literally am struggling to remember who plays for what team in the Premier League. I've been reading up on it ahead of restart and I'm going through, you know, team profiles and going, oh, I completely forgotten that guy was at Aston Villa or whatever. You know, Villa have John McGinn back from injury when they had originally thought he'd be out for the season. He was really good. Will he be enough to save them? Maybe. Who knows? Jack Grealish dirtied his bib early in lockdown by, you know, attending a party and becoming public enemy number one, I think, until Kyle Walker very manfully stepped up to the plate and saved his blushes. I am really, I, like Jonathan, thought restart was a really bad idea, and a small, really spiteful part of me that I'm thoroughly ashamed of wants it all to go horribly wrong just so I can have been proved right. But I am also really looking forward to it. I'm a sort of excitement about this that I don't think I've felt about, say, the start of a season for quite a very long time, because the off season now, it doesn't really exist. Even if there isn't a tournament, there's always something on. But in the past 3 months, we've had nothing, like nothing. I unless you count a couple of Bundesliga games, which I must confess I find very hard to get excited about, even though I've watched a couple.
I the thing about form, I guess, is, you know, the league table is still there. So you imagine if Sheffield United take the lead early, you can see the Villa very quickly remembering what had happened and the form they were in, I guess, Johnny.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting elements of this is people talk about the home advantage being eroded without crowds. I think the idea of ebb and flow in a game and momentum swinging is so dependent on the feeling and the colour in a stadium that I think you're going to see, and I don't know if there's any figures on this from the Bundesliga, for example, but once a team goes 2-0 up, you kind of need a crowd to come back from 2-0 down at home. And I wonder whether you're going to see less of that happen. So if Sheffield United go a goal up at Villa Park, you would generally expect the crowd to sort of, right, come on, guys, let's make a comeback. And I think without that, it's going to feel very strange. And I think you're going to see a lot more one-sided games where the better team simply wins in a very simple fashion.
So look, Villa are 19th. They've got 25 points. If they win, they'll go above Bournemouth, Watford and West Ham. It's incredibly tight at the bottom. Sheffield United, if they win their game, they will go into fifth place, which may well be a possible Champions League place. Barry, do you think Sheffield United should have the view, look, whatever we do, it's been a great season? Or should they now think, we are never going to get a better chance to get in the Champions League, and if we don't do it, I'm not saying, oh, that's failure, because that's ludicrous, but they're never going to have a better chance than this, are they?
Well, I kind of feel a little sorry for Sheffield United. I'm sure they don't want my pity, but they're not sure if fifth will be good enough to qualify for the Champions League. And even if they do qualify for the Champions League, there's no guarantee the Champions League will actually happen next season. So double doubt, I suppose. But yeah, absolutely, they should go for it. They're a cracking team. They're very, very accomplished side. They've had a brilliant season, and they know how good they are. They know what they're capable of. So absolutely, they should go for it. It might not be coming fifth might not amount to much for them in the end, but you know, at least put yourself in the position to be outraged or disappointed if it turns out that the Champions League doesn't happen next season. I suspect it will, but we don't know for sure yet. And we're obviously waiting for the outcome of the Man City case.
Sure. You mentioned City. They play Arsenal 8:15 on Wednesday. Pep versus Arteta in the dugout for the first time. Arteta said in his press conference, as a coach, I've learned so much from him. We've spent some amazing moments together, some difficult as well. The experience next to him has been incredible. The big story coming out of Arsenal, Johnny, is Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and whether he's going to stay or not. I still find it strange having conversations about players and where they're going to go, but what would you do if you were Aubameyang? What would you do?
I think he's got all the cards at the moment. If I were Aubameyang, sort of trying to make that sort of neural shift. But yeah, I think I'd probably sit tight, wait and see what transpires. The thing about the market at the moment is there is so much uncertainty. There are so many unknowns that, you know, it's not clear which clubs are going to be recruiting, what their budgets are going to be, you know, what his options actually are. So I think actually being able to concentrate on these last 8 or 9 games will be like quite a benefit for him, because, you know, he'll have had a bit of time to rest. He'll have had a bit of time to sort of to train, and I think he'll benefit from just being able to concentrate on this run-in.
If you were Pep, Baz, what would you do with these games before the Champions League takes place, if it all goes according to plan, which I know you don't want it to, but if it does, would you just sort of rotate everybody, keep everyone ticking over? You're not going to win the league. You're not going to drop out the top four, but you can still win the Champions League, which is, given what might happen, is even bigger, right, for Pep?
Yeah, I think it's dangerous to presume you will be able to just switch it on for the Champions League mini tournament or whatever way they work it. So I would probably treat every Premier League game as being very important. But the thing is, I mean, their squad is so strong that switching things around and giving everyone a run out, you've got two brilliant first teams there. So if I was Pep, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you.
How dare you? Anyway, look, we'll look back at those games and we'll look ahead to the rest of the Premier League on Thursday's pod. Jordan Jarrett Bryan, Jonathan Wilson are going to join us for that. Let's cross now to Spain. Say hello to Sid Lowe. Now La Liga is back. Sid, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks, Max. How are you?
Oh, tremendous. Thanks very much for asking. How was the return of La Liga for you?
I suppose it depends on which bit of it you're looking at, because obviously there's a big difference between the return of the games on television, which is how all of us are going to have to experience almost all of the games, and then the one game I was able to go to, and the experience of that, of course, was very different. I think there was a sense amongst most football fans that they were really pleased to have it back, that the quality of the football was probably better than some people had feared. I think that games were maybe a bit more intense than we'd anticipated. I think we probably all thought that physically teams might not be in good shape, but the early evidence is that actually they are in pretty good shape, and maybe the test will come later on, you know, when they're right in the middle of this run of playing 11 games in 5 weeks. Maybe that's when we'll see how physically strong they are. But the response was good. There were some things that were surprising. You know, there were games that were pretty dirty. Granada Getafe was very dirty. I thought the performance from Sevilla in the Seville derby was very good. Both Madrid and Barcelona won perhaps a little bit too easily to properly judge what kind of level they're at. But all in all, it was actually quite an enjoyable return to football, I think.
Yeah, I remember you saying that, you know, the fact that Getafe Granada was so dirty was quite a relief, because it, we were worried about it all being lacking intensity, and it was just great to see two sets of teams just kicking lumps out of each other.
Yeah, and the thing about that, in a way, was certainly in the first half, that because there was no crowd, and so you didn't kind of get, if you like, that packaging that goes around it, and the increase in the noise, and the sense that this is going to really kick off. They were sort of making three or four challenges that in the first half that you thought this would kick off if there was the kind of the associated noise with it, and it didn't. But then bit by bit it got closer. I'm going to get this stat wrong, Max, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but I mean, it doesn't really matter because the point remains the same. I saw a stat that suggested that the foul count was so high and the completed pass stat was so low that it was something like, and I'm probably getting this very wrong, but it was still a startling statistic. It was something like, for every 9 completed passes, there was a foul, which I think tells you quite a lot about the game.
Yeah, that's the kind of football I like. You say it's quite hard to gauge from Real Madrid and Barcelona sort of where they are, given how straightforward their games were. But can you gauge it for us anyway?
Well, I mean, look, they both scored, I think it was 65 seconds and 160 seconds or something, the two goals from them. So they then kind of eased into it really quite early. That said, Barcelona were probably... they probably conceded more opportunities to Mallorca than they would have liked. Real Madrid then had a collapse in the second half, but I think the collapse in the second half came when they started making multiple substitutions. And by the way, we're going to see this, I think. The early evidence of La Liga is we're going to see every team very conscious of the fact that they're playing 11 games in 5 weeks, making their 5 changes every game. And so I think that will make the second halves feel a little bit kind of pre-season friendly-ish. But both Madrid and Barcelona, I thought they both looked quick. They were good on the ball. In Real Madrid's case, the return of Hazard and his relationship and understanding with Benzema looks like it might be really quite significant. In Barcelona's case, obviously, look, and I hate to reduce it to one man, but you know, there's a temptation to do so, and there's also a basic reality there. Messi came back and thought, oh, he's still quite good at football.
And Real Madrid's training ground's quite nice, isn't it?
It's very nice. This is where Real Madrid's B team Castilla play, so it's not a place that hasn't had fans in before. It's a ground that gets used. The training ground itself is spectacular. I mean, it maybe lacks a little bit of feeling because it's quite new, so it's still quite kind of, I suppose you could call it sterile, but I don't think that's entirely fair. It's just kind of a bit pristine still. It doesn't feel very lived in, but it's an absolutely fantastic training ground that they've got. And the place where they're playing, the Di Stefano Stadium, is, I think it holds 5,000. It hasn't got ends, so it's only got stands on either side, but it's very smart indeed. And of course, the quality of the surface is even better than the Bernabeu.
And they CGI'd a crowd onto one stand, and they had the crowd noise. And does this make me a... I don't know what this. I don't know if it makes me a terrible person. I actually quite liked it.
Well, I mean, this has been part of the debates. In fact, quite a big part of the whole debate about the return of Spanish football has been this question of the CGI fans and the crowd noise. And it's all the grounds, by the way, and it's been done on the television rather than in the stadiums. Although, if you watch the Mallorca game without the crowd, without the CGI, you still got the crowd because Mallorca were actually doing it in the ground. So they were putting it through the loudspeakers in the ground as well, which confused me, I must admit, because I went onto the non-CGI version and thought, why can I still hear fans here? My favourite moment from this weekend of CGI fans and crowd noise was the Real Sociedad Osasuna game. And in the first half, and I must confess, apologies, I can't remember who it was. He's clean through in the area. He puts the ball past the goalkeeper. It's going in. And presumably the sound technician has pressed the button that says goal. And the crowd cheer and the ball goes wide. to kind of answer your question, I have a theory that you say you don't know if it makes you wrong. I don't know if this makes me a bit weird. But I have a theory, which is that in a way, I don't mind it, and I certainly don't mind it as much as I thought I would, because it's not very good, if you see what I mean. So what I mean by that is, it's not massively intrusive, right? So when they said CGI fans, I really did think, right, this is going to look like FIFA. It's going to, you know, we're going to be really conscious of them. It's going to kind of really kind of get in our eye line, and we're going to... And also, I think there's a kind of underneath it, I feel like there's almost an ethical question of the ease with which we're replacing fans, which makes me feel uneasy. But anyway, what happened was that, as you've seen, the graphics really are just some sort of coloured blobs on the stands, kind of superimposed on the stands. It looks like FIFA looked 15 years ago. I imagine it's really difficult to do, because obviously this makes me sound like I'm being a smart ass, and I imagine technologically this is really hard, and I'm not trying to say, oh, I could have done better fans than that. But I actually quite like the fact that it was just a bit of colouring in the stands, because it didn't feel like it was kind of shouting me in the face, and I didn't feel like it was right there. And also the crowd noise has largely been quite low-key and unintrusive until, as I said, that Real Sociedad game when they celebrated a goal that didn't happen.
I'm no strong feelings about CGI fans one way or the other, but I think if you're going to have them, you might as well go all out and, you know, sort of have animals wearing hats and, make, you know, space aliens from Star Wars, you know, with weird...
They could actually do that, couldn't they? They could take the scene from the bar in Star Wars, yeah, have all of those characters in the stands, and you know, maybe have an away fan walk into the part of the stand and have one of them saying, "I don't like you."
Yeah, Jabba the Hutt up in the expensive
in the director's box.
Sid, in the Bundesliga, I think most teams sort of turned up being about as good as they were, with a couple of exceptions. Is that the same in La Liga?
It does feel more or less like that. I mean, the big surprise, I suppose the big surprise, if you look at the first round of games, maybe is Espanyol against Alaves. And Espanyol didn't just beat Alaves, and Espanyol have been in big trouble for a while, and they're still bottom. But they absolutely destroyed them. You know, I think the shot count at the end was 19-0. I mean, obviously, it helped that Alaves had their goalkeeper sent off really early on. And I think that was the one kind of performance that was really dramatically, if you like, kind of out of place with what we'd seen before. But apart from that, it does look broadly similar, yeah.
Jonathan Lewis just dropped the bombshell that he's never seen Star Wars. Have you never seen any Star Wars, Johnny?
Not any of them. There's nine, is that?
Yeah. I don't know. But
there's not nine real ones. I mean, this is the thing, is it? I mean,
there's am nine, I making myself and then an old there's a man? Couple of standalone ones, so I reckon 12.
Yeah, but there's three, really, isn't there?
There's three. And is this now a badge of honour, Johnny, or do you...
I've just never felt the need. They're not real. It's not real. It never will be.
That is like when Didi Haman said he didn't like fiction to me.
It's a little bit like that. Yeah.
But I'm heartbroken that you've just said, Johnny, that it's not real. What do you mean it's not real? I thought this was a documentary series. I'm really frightened now.
What a terrible way to find out. Anyway, given that this is what we're talking about, it's probably a good time to finish. Thanks so much, Sid, for coming on.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Johnny.
Oh, cheers, family.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday. Me, Barry, Jonathan Wilson, Jordan Jarrett Bryan, looking back at those two Premier League games and the first full fixture list for months.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.